Yeah, a lot of controlled chaos.
Playing by ear, so I can see your fans.
Yeah, exactly. Just controlled chaos. That's what veterinary medicine is, controlled chaos.
Yeah, seriously.
Hey, everybody. It's Dr. G. I'm back again. Welcome to another episode of Irreplaceable Truths. I am here with another Dr. G.
Yep, that's me.
He comes from Irvine, California, Costa Mesa now. You went to Pomona undergrad?
Yep.
You went to Midwestern in Arizona?
Yeah, first graduating class.
Woo woo!
Woo!
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That so, was a good one. I'm going to go on that. You're my first Midwestern vet.
Great.
I would love to hear that whole concept.
Yeah.
And you've been doing a lot of relief work now.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty much only relief work at this point and loving it. That's great.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go back. So, Midwestern.
Yeah.
First class.
First graduating class, yeah. It was intense. It was really cool because we were, 105, 110 kids, students, and that was it. It was a full faculty of veterinarians, veterinary professionals, and the 110 of us. And it felt so much like a little family. And then each year we got another class, and it just got bigger and bigger and stretched more and more. And by the end of it, it was just kind of one of those things of like, I do miss like that closeness that we had at the very beginning.
The intimacy of it all.
Yeah.
Was Tina Villarette there with you?
I don't know.
Dr. Tina Villarette. She was a teacher there.
I don't think so.
She's the new dean of the vet school that's starting in Indiana.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So how was it? Where's the campus?
It's in the capital of Arizona. I'm totally blanking, right? So
Mesa.
Phoenix, there we go. Thank you. So it's in Glendale, just like northeast.
Right next to where the Cardinals play.
Northwest. Yeah, right. So we were kind of like just north of there. Arizona, that was a rough place to be, especially during the summer. Do not want to be there at all. So that was kind of a hard part of being there. But then you just jump back to Southern California, which was nice. Go to the beach, hang out, get back out there.
Do you ever go down to Rocky Point at all?
No, I never did. Yeah. When I got in, so it took me 5 years to get into vet school. So I made like a commitment to myself of like, I'm going to be so focused on just trying to be the best vet that I can, not fail out of vet school. I was one of the older kids in that class. And so I just tried my best. I was in the library every single day for like 5 hours a day, just studying my butt off, trying to do the best I could.
Really?
Yeah.
You were one of the gunners. I used to call them the gunners.
Yeah. Yeah, front of the class.
Oh, my gosh.
I was the student. I was the question student, right? I was the one that, like, every class I had my hand up at least five times, the one everyone hates.
So since you were the first class there.
Yeah.
If you were to look back and let's compare it to Colorado State or a Cornell or an Illinois or a Davis, how would you explain your class compared to what would be at your, historically already made?
Yeah, established.
Veterinary school.
And I've told this before, like the thing that I loved the most was that they were all new teachers, right? So we were getting veterinarians from those schools teaching us. So we had communication courses where we had actors coming in, pretending to be clients. And that was a Cornell student veterinarian who came through and used Cornell's their already well-known and established communication courses. And that was kind of what it was that all of these veterinarians were coming in from different areas, and we got an amalgamation of all of the best parts of each school. And that was really cool. We had a mixture of problem-based learning, a mixture of, in-class learning, and I really just enjoyed kind of being able to see all the different things and meet these veterinarians who were coming from those different schools and utilize the best parts of that.
Where did you do clinics, your clinical?
Yeah, so that was an interesting one because it was kind of like being the first class, they didn't really have it set up yet. And I, for most of my clinics, I was just cold calling doctors and like, hey, do you have a month that I can come and follow you as a student? And, so I was down in Orange County for a few months. I was going to different hospitals. We did have a teaching hospital. It wasn't it wasn't super busy, but we had clients coming through, and because it was started the first year that we were there, by the third and a half year, we were getting enough people coming through in the Phoenix area to kind of like keep things going. So I had an emergency, I had surgery, we had all the normal stuff, large animal stuff too, because Arizona is known to have their large animal side of it. So outside of me calling and just like going and working with like random doctors, we did have a structured kind of clinical rotation.
You did?
Yeah.
With the, you look back at that education, what were you lacking?
What was I lacking?
What do you wish they would have taught you in veterinary school more?
I mean, the thing that like, I don't know if this is even teachable. The thing that like really got me was my first surgery on my own, standing there as the doctor. I mean, I've been in the veterinary field since I was, I think like 12. I mean, I volunteered at the shelter, like the Irvine Animal Shelter in middle school. So like from then on, I was jumping into hospitals and volunteering, and I worked at the Orange County Zoo as a relief keeper. And I ended up working with the doctor that did Santa Ana Zoo, Orange County Zoo. And so I was seeing all these things, and I thought I was going to be like a real good surgeon. One, I ended up finding out that I don't like surgeons. They're an intense group of people. And two, being the individual that's responsible for that life on that table in that moment is very terrifying. And so it really was one of those things of like, when I was going through surgeries through school, there was always another doctor. You know, there was always that professor that was right behind your back if something went wrong. And to be in that moment, that was just something that I was lacking of like the reality of what it was actually going to be. And then also, it's just like the culture of veterinary medicine is difficult. You have to learn how to play other doctors. You have to learn how to play off of other doctors and be around other doctors and the egos. Like, that's something that I was thinking about this podcast and was like, ego, that's like my theme for veterinary medicine, is like, how do you function around these egos of these people that just think that they're
perfect?
Yeah. And you have to be, right? I mean, like, that's the hard part. And that was also something that I found out too, going through veterinary medicine, is like, no, none of us are, and we're all just bullshitting. And nobody wants to talk about that. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that, like, oh, you know, the tech comes up to you and is like, oh, what dose do you give for this pet? And I'll have doctors that I, you know, that have been working for 20, 30 years just, like, throw out the dose. And it's like, did they even calculate it? Did they, you know, and it's like an idea of, oh, this pet is this size. Well, it's going to be that for, like, Clavamox, right?
And, well, Clavamox is easy, dude.
Well, so, yeah, I mean, some of them
are. Let's go a little harder. No, I, you know, the thing is that I was in the profession for 32 years, and you just learn.
Right.
You learn. You're like, yeah. Oh, 70-pound dog, oh, that's 0.7 torb. Right. You just keep moving, you know? And you just learn that's like a cc per 10, you know, a cc per right. 10 of cefazolin. Yeah. You know, you learn these things, and you're just like, oh, let's go with it. And that's totally the one thing I would teach my staff, is I always like, keep medicine simple.
Right.
Right. For me, medicine was always very easy. Mm. I enjoyed surgery.
Yeah.
The one thing that was hardest for me to learn was the game of playing with the clients.
That's the one thing that I do not have a hard time with. I think because it took me so long to get into vet school, I didn't get so engrossed into that hospital life that like it's me separated from them. And I also just have that mind of where like I'm a doctor, and I'm finally okay with like admitting that to myself now. That was kind of hard, right? At the very beginning, you don't really feel like you are.
You had imposter syndrome.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah. I mean, I think so many of us did. And so, but like, I don't feel like I'm too separate from that client in those moments where like I'm the doctor on the ground, I'm petting their dog. Like, through working at the zoo, I learned how to minimize my energy, because all of the animals are terrified of you. And if you walk into like a island fox enclosure, that fox is running away. How do you train that fox if they're on the other side of the enclosure afraid of you, right? So like, I'm that doctor that I make myself small, I get down on the ground, I'm using my little baby voice to talk to them. And clients love that. Oh man, that eats them up.
Right. Yeah, because they're fur baby.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, clients already somewhat, if the animal's sick especially, coming stressed.
Yeah, oh, 100%.
And then the animal gets there, and the animal gets stressed.
Yep.
And that stresses out the client even more.
Yeah.
And the emotions that clients start showing towards you are truly not how they feel about you.
Yeah.
But it's just, we're humans.
Right.
Right? A lot of us have a hard time controlling our emotions and controlling how we communicate when our emotions are high.
Totally.
The trick is to always be empathetic, always be calm, never panic.
Right. That's a big one.
That's so easily to say, right?
Yeah.
But, you just, even if you just walk in there and just walk in confidently and talk confident and then say, oh, yeah, I'll be back in a second. And you can go and run in the back and look this up, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, just
that,
to,
that's
just
something
to
you got to teach the new vets, right? Like you got to tell them how to do that. So many of them don't realize that that's like in our playbook for all of us. Like, oh, I don't know what to do here. Let me, you know, like, oh, I left my pen.
Yeah.
Oh, this one's dead. Sorry. Yeah. You know, I got to go back.
Oh shoot, my stethoscope.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, this is mine.
Yeah.
This
exactly.
Is somebody else's.
Oh, I don't want to put this away. I'll be right back.
Yeah.
But it's a game. It's a game you got to learn.
Yeah.
And it's a fun game, but a lot of early career veterinarians, they're so used to being perfect all the time that learning that game is very, very hard.
Yeah. Well, and I think that the process of becoming a veterinarian, you have to be that like straight A student. And for me, like I never was. Although I said that, you know, in vet school, I was in the library all the time. I was the like B plus student. And that's probably what took me so long to get into vet school all by itself. But at the same time, like I wanted to live life. I wanted to be able to make friends and go be social. That was just something in me already. But I feel like to become a veterinarian, so many of these vet students are like, you do nothing but get good grades and you do nothing but go work at the hospital. They're not spending enough time out in the world learning about how to be social. And that's, oh man, I don't know. What kind of percentage do you think that is of our job?
Oh, it's, I would say 85 to 90.
I was thinking like 75, yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, because every four-legged animal has a two-legged checkbook, right?
Yeah.
That makes the decisions.
And they're the ones that are the only ones that can actually give you the information on what's actually happening. So many of them don't actually know what's happening.
No.
But at the same time, like, those history questions that we have to ask.
Especially when the husband brings the dog in and is the wife that made the appointment.
Those are the worst.
Yeah. There's a lump.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where is that, sir?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. My wife found it.
Yeah. Can I call my wife? And you can talk to my wife on the phone?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it keeps going on and on and on. Right. I mean, there's so many crazy stories like that.
Yeah. Every day.
You said it took you 5 years to get into vet school.
Yeah.
What did you do for those 5 years?
Yeah. So I graduated undergrad in 2009. And so that was kind of like right when the economy was crashing, right? So it was difficult to find a job in general. I didn't have enough hospital experience to be able to just jump into a hospital and be a tech. One, not to like jump into the whole like sexist side of things, but I think like being a man going into most of these hospitals where most of it is female driven, just didn't work well for me for whatever reason. And so I was having a hard time getting into hospitals. I ended up working at like a law firm as a clerk, a box clerk, and just doing, you know, ends meet to survive. And I ended up volunteering at the Orange County Zoo on my weekends. And they could see that I could handle the animals and that I could, you know, I knew what I was talking about with my pre-vet undergrad degree. And they ended up hiring me part-time as a keeper. And so I did that for 4 years with that. And then working with the zoo veterinarians, that kind of was what ended up where when I went into Midwestern and finally was accepted into vet school, thank all the powers above. They were just kind of like, I don't know how you didn't get scooped up before this. And that was the dean talking to me about it. And I was just so grateful that he saw in me what I knew was there and he was willing to take that chance.
Well, it's very interesting because there you are, you worked with animals in an animal setting for many years and it still took you 5 years to get in.
I know why I didn't get in.
Well, you didn't get in because they accept on IQ, not EQ.
And I wasn't getting good references, is what my dean ended up telling me.
Oh, really?
Second year of vet school, yeah. I asked him for a reference, and he, not to like get into the bogs of this, but he was like, hey, Greg, make sure you ask for a good letter of recommendation when you're asking for a letter of recommendation. And I go, like, what does that mean? He's like, I don't really want to tell you exactly what that means.
So these people you're asking from the bottom of your heart to help you out were actually bamboozling you.
From what I came to find out, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, see, those are the ones that deserve a glitter bomb. You ever heard of a glitter bomb?
Oh, man. I can never find them.
That's really? Always,
yeah. Each time I look for one.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, that's too bad.
Yeah.
So your class at Midwestern, what do you think was the average GPA you think in theory should have been lower than all the other traditional vet schools that were opened up at that?
Yeah, I think it was. Not by much, I don't think. But they knew from the beginning that they needed to get a different set of students. They couldn't just get that, like, ordinary veterinary student because we were the first class and we had to develop everything. I was the SGA president for the first 2 years, Student Government Association. I was class president. Like, in the end, like, each of us had to be very self-motivated and be able to function without everything already being present. And so they kind of went at it selecting students that they knew were, maybe they weren't going to be the best students of all time, but were going to be hardy enough to survive.
Yeah, exactly. Because you would think those higher GPAs ended up at your Texas A&M, your Cornell, your
right.
Colorado State,
yeah,
stuff like that.
Right.
Did you have an interview before you went?
Yeah, definitely. I remember driving.
They're optional now.
Are they now?
Midwestern.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, that's, I don't know if I like that.
Yeah, there's some vet schools you can get into without an interview.
Oh. Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that. I think a big part of this is like, one, I think that the acceptance process is a little bit skewed in the sense of, like, too many of us are looking for ourselves in these students and trying to find someone that matches what we think is the appropriate veterinarian. And I think that I don't think that it diversifies us enough to give us.
That's funny you say that, because my whole dissertation is based off the attraction, selection, attrition theory.
Mm.
And basically, I believe, I don't have the data yet, and maybe I'll be proven wrong, but we're accepting the same type of students mm-hmm. over and over and over again, right. And we're kind of just painting ourselves into a box, right?
Yeah.
And right. You're not going to get that diversification. So if you've been bitching and complaining about burnout for the last 15 years, maybe we need to look at a different type of personality or a different type of trait right. that might be able to have resilience
right.
when it comes to this profession.
Absolutely.
I think just making the whole profession acceptance off IQ,
mm-hmm.
which is a huge, everyone's like, oh, it's not just IQ. A great majority of it is
yeah.
IQ.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, that's the first filter.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't have a 4.0, which is IQ, ideas of IQ, right?
Right.
You're not even looked at.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. So, but you know, I was the veterinary student that went by the equation C equals DVM.
Yeah. In the end, that's what it is.
It is.
And you never
just got to pass. You got to be a doctor.
Right. You just got to pass that NAVLE.
Yeah. So another argument I have is I think it drives me crazy that students are being accepted into veterinary school with no hours. Previous experience, only 100 hours required, but you have...
100?
100.
Dang, I had like 10,000.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that's my whole thing. You had 10,000 and you had difficulty getting in.
Right.
If you have 10,000 hours at the same place,
right.
maybe you could look at those letters of recommendation and go, why didn't they fire this guy if he was so bad?
Right. You would think so, right?
Right?
Yeah.
But that's the problem is they're not looking at having a realistic career preview.
Right.
Looking into, hey, this really is the profession for me.
Yeah.
You know, I will have, the other independent variable, I'm looking at a few, but another thing I'm looking at is professional identity. Mm. My values match
right.
what is required to be a successful veterinarian.
Yeah.
Right? Work-life balance, if that's your highest value, this might not be the profession for you.
I don't 100% agree with that, because I think in some cases, like what I'm doing, I am able to find that. But I hear what you're saying. I understand that.
But the problem is that the whole profession, I think, at least here in Southern California, is being driven by relief.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I think there's in other states or other cities and things too, right? 100%.
What about veterinarians that are doing relief work 4 months, 5 months out of school as their job?
Man. That's scary. That's so many of my days, I'm the only veterinarian in that hospital. And there's no way I knew what I was doing well enough that early on to be able to run a hospital. I mean, I didn't even know how to do CPR right back then, you know? So, like, when you get an actual emergency case through.
0.1 per 10. There you go. There was the epinephrine dose, atropine dose. There's, sorry.
There you go.
Okay.
Yeah. Staying alive. Staying alive.
Yeah, exactly.
Just stick with that.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, you said, how do they have those doses? I could still tell you.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, I remember freezing up at the beginning when, you know, hit by cars would come in, the staff being like, what do we do, doctor? What do we do?
Don't panic.
Right. Right. Take a breath. I mean, I ended up making little booklets. So I have like an address book that has all my drugs in it. So that's all the doses that I like. And then I have a little journal that is all of the diseases that are complicated or, you know, you can't find easily. And all the little notes that I have of like what I like and what I don't like and all the things. And so, you know, on the front page of that is my emergency sheet of like, take a breath, A, B, C, D, you know, just hook them up, take a breath and hook them up.
What about Veterinary Information Network?
Oh, I use that all the time. Yes. I'm on that
Vin is a huge resource.
Yeah, every day.
And if for early career professionals, if they're at a practice that won't pay for a Vin subscription,
yeah.
Number one, maybe you should look somewhere else. But number two, pay for it yourself.
Right. Oh, it's so valuable. I mean, I look on there at least every week on just like the 3D anatomy, just to like refresh, right? Like all the different muscles and everything.
Don't cut it. That's the, you know, everyone's like, what muscle is that? I don't know. Yeah. I just don't touch it.
try to dissect around it.
Yeah. Don't touch that one. I mean, seriously. I mean, the biggest thing I remember, like linea alba, you know, cause that's used all the time.
Right.
And the one that really was fun was the Margo plicatus.
Huh. Interesting.
The Margo plicatus, you remember what that was?
I don't actually, yeah.
That's the separation between the acidic and non-acidic part of the stomach.
Oh, nice.
The glandular and non-glandular stomach.
Okay.
I just like the name Margo plicatus. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So when it comes to relief work, what can you tell these early career vets that are jumping into it too soon?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, it took me, I was doing relief, I started probably relief at, like, a year and a half where I was going to, like, Banfields and just kind of doing wellness things, like, on one of my days off because I was working 4 days a week and one of the days I'd, you know, pick up another shift or something like that. But I think, like, it really comes down to if you are working at a hospital right out of vet school and you have other doctors around, when you are the only doctor there, how does that make you feel? If you are nervous to be the only doctor there, do not get into relief medicine yet because you will be the only doctor at most of these hospitals.
And the one thing, I like having another doctor there just, I mean, I was doing it for 25 years. Yeah. I always wanted a doctor with me because you never know when that afternoon that looks dead.
Right.
All of a sudden turns into pyo, bloat.
Yeah,
all these
hit
things.
By car.
And another thing is that a lot of these relief veterinarians, because they don't have the experience, I don't do surgery, I don't see emergencies, I don't do this, I don't do that. You're prerogative, but why did you go to vet school?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not doing surgery for the most part, doing relief, just because I would jump around to so many different hospitals that I would never have continuity of care. You know, if I would go to a hospital and I'd work there enough and be able to trust the staff, like I don't want to walk into a hospital I've never been to, not know anyone there and not know what's going on and then be thrown into like five large dog fat spays.
Right.
You know, like that's just and 20 appointments throughout the day.
Correct. And then so, still wondering in the back of your head, is that 120 pound lab bleeding out?
Right.
Right.
Yeah. You never know.
And you don't know how good the staff is at monitoring postoperatively during.
Yeah.
Preoperatively, postoperatively, during operative.
Yeah.
I mean,
right, yeah, yeah. You don't even know if they're RVTs or not, right? So, like, I'll walk into hospitals and I'm seeing trach tubes thrown down throats. And I'm like, I don't think you're an RVT. And that's not allowed.
Well, California's changed. You can do it.
As long as you're directed.
Right, directed, right. But, you know, I was very blessed to have RVTs. I was very blessed to mentor, you know, 20 employees into vet school.
Yeah.
I had many employees that I mentored through the RVT program. I believe in education. I believe in them learning. But, I mean, if you have a solid staff, your day is amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's the biggest thing, I think, for us as veterinarians. Like, so many hospitals that I have gone to and worked at prior to becoming a vet, culture just sucks. I mean, I was saying this the other day at another hospital. Like, I remember when I was much younger going to these hospitals volunteering and, like, wondering what some of these technicians did on their off time. Like, they looked very strange.
You play that game?
People. You know, like, what do you do when you go home?
Yeah.
You know, like, okay.
Serial killer?
Yeah. Like, you know, are there a lot of needles around your house?
Exactly.
And so, like, I think that if you can find the right people and surround yourself with them, like in anything, I guess, right? Life in general, then you're made for success.
Right. I could look at relief as a way to do a working interview.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you like the practice, you like the culture.
Very true.
You like how you see how efficient and effective the staff is.
Yeah.
The clients aren't bad. That might be a place for you.
True.
Right?
Absolutely.
When you do relief, have you done private and corporate practices?
Yeah.
Do you see a difference between the way the practices are run?
Yeah, I mean, I think that depending on, you know, which corporate company you're talking about, you know, is it owned by Mars? There's a very black and white to a lot of that. As we kind of know, for private practices, it's usually run by people like you, where, you know, if you've been there for 30 years, and you're just kind of like, you're just so into it, and it's been your life for so long that the hospital runs under you, like it knows you. And then to be a relief walking into that's kind of hard, because like I'll go into some hospitals and they're not taking TPRs. You're just walking into that room, and because the other doctor, you know, the primary doctor, he does them himself, or you know, she does them themselves, you know, and then you're just kind of like, wait, what? Well, I'm so used to the normal routine of like, here's the history questions given to you, here's the TPR. But then some of these, you know, private practices, you're walking in and you're like, oh crap, this is like all on me.
Right. I would make sure that all rectal temps were taken in back, because a lot of clients do not appreciate that.
Well, and so many of the pets don't either.
All right.
Yeah. You walk in and that pet's already pissed.
I know. I mean, yeah. It was pretty cool. I mean, the ear thermometer came out for a while.
Dude, I got one of those in my pocket every day. That's my primary. If it looks weird, get the rectal. But if it looks normal,
yeah,
and they look normal.
I mean, people are like, oh, you know, I don't know. It said 102.3.
Yeah.
Well, the dog's a 2-year-old, you know, crazy Dalmatian that just came from the dog park.
Right.
And it's here for, you know, a Bordetella. I think we're okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we're okay.
Yeah, do you see it? It won't sit still. I think everything's fine.
Yeah, the dog hiding under the chair, shaking.
Right, but that's still another trick. Like, those things can be taken in back, not in front of the owner.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
I always believe the less the owner sees the dog, you know, going through stuff, the better the conversation can be.
What do you, you're the interviewer, if you're okay with me asking you a question.
Sure, go for it.
One of the new things is to have these like open window hospitals.
Modern.
Right?
Yeah, what do you think of that? Right down the street that just opened.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
I think it's going to work for the millennial pet owner. I think it's going to work for the Gen Z pet owner. But I think it's going to, there's a huge chance that it could come back and bite them in the rear, because the owner's going to see something, and that's their only thing is see, not hear, not smell, not taste, nothing. See,
yeah,
and they're going to. They say a picture's worth a thousand words. they're going to say, oh, my dog was doing that. I saw that.
Yeah.
I think there are veterinarians that'll be good for. I think it's you're going to be very limited to what you can do.
I think that's the biggest problem is, like, you're saying, like, the clientele being millennials, Gen Z. I think that the Gen Z millennial veterinarian is going to be having a real problem with that.
Yeah, well, maybe not, because they're all, I mean,
because they're all, like,
they're having
media.
Less children. There was an article that came out, I think, I don't know who sent it to me, but it was in Forbes, that they're having less children and are having more animals instead.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean,
which is good for the profession.
Yeah.
But it's also scary for the profession, because a red flag is always when a owner comes in and said, this is my fur baby.
Right. Yeah, you got to be super careful with those people. Yeah.
Right? You just got to be careful. You have to have a different conversation. Mm-hmm. Not saying that they're not great people.
Right.
But you're going to have to, instead of being the veterinarian, turn into the pediatrician.
Right, yeah. The therapist.
Yes. Yeah. So, and those can be very difficult.
Yeah.
But those are also can be very rewarding.
Well, those are the clients that you really want.
Right.
I mean, if you own that practice, those are the people that are your bread. You know, they're the ones coming through and feeding you consistently, because they are so honed in on their pet, whatever that means, right? Mm. That they think that no matter what is off is a problem, and they got to be with you. And those are the ones that if you don't approach them appropriately, you're going to lose them, and then you're going to get something else crazy.
What about when you graduated? Did you work private practice first?
No, I went straight into a corporate. It was too tempting. You know, it was
the money.
The opportunities. I mean, so, like, you know, the whole story of that is, like, I get hired on. They fly me out from Arizona. I ended up kind of, like, working both sides of the Mars options, and ended up picking the VCA side over the Banfield side. But they treated me like, you know, a king. They flew me out. They put me up in hotels. They got me a car. They were taking me out to lunch and dinner. And so that was nice. That what I'm finding now is these private practices just don't have the means to do those kind of things, right? And so I ended up going with VCA.
You mean they don't have the $500 billion checkbook?
Right. Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, and you can't really expect them to either, right? But what ended up happening was that when I got hired on, a doctor left. And then when that doctor left, another doctor left. So I was told I was going to get mentored. And I know this is one of your other things too, right? I was told I was going to get mentored, and that mentor left. So I was at that hospital.
By yourself?
There was another doctor there. But
that doctor... Did they want to mentor you?
No.
No, exactly.
No. And they were very holistic.
Oh.
And so me coming out of vet school with numbers, you know, in my mind and all the new science ideas, don't use antibiotics for a urinary tract infection, you know, like, do, you know, all those kind of new ideas. And this doctor was like, I can't even work with you, because I would question them. Like, why aren't you doing like this? Not like aggressively or anything, right? But it was just kind of like my personality in general. I like to learn. I like to know what's going on. I like to pick brains and see what is inside of that brain and understand it better. And they didn't like that.
How long did you last there?
I ended up staying there, I think, for like 3.5 years.
Oh, but you made it a while.
Yeah. I mean, part of it was like, one, imposter syndrome was really hard, because I don't feel like I was, I didn't feel like I could go anywhere else for a while. I felt like if I went anywhere else, I would be found out to be a fraud.
So let's stop there. Was that because of your education, or was that because of your mentoring afterwards, or?
It was about the people that I was working with making me feel small, making it so that it was difficult for me to think that I actually was doing a good job.
From the very top down, or just in your particular practice?
Not necessarily like the very top. I had a really good regional manager who was very supportive and would, you know, I could call, and they were very nice to me and available. Some of the others,
but they couldn't correct a lot of the problems.
Right. And I mean, and the other side is, like, you know, I don't want to like throw anyone under the bus, or if they ever hear this and feel bad about it, like, everyone's got their own problems, right? Everyone's got their own things to deal with, and everyone's trying to deal with it the best way that they can. But I'm dealing with my problems in the way that I am, and I don't need your problems put on me. I don't need the stress that you feel put onto me, like, please keep your stress where it is and let me deal with my stress and let's not merge those together. That was a big problem.
That was.
Yeah.
And that was the other doctor, the office manager, the technicians?
Yeah, that was, I mean, that was, yeah, that was definitely in the doctor realm.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. The problem is that there is no solid mentoring per se once students graduate.
Right.
It's one thing for someone to say they're going to do it. It's another for them to actually do it.
Right.
I enjoyed mentoring. I've been getting surprise guests, you know.
That's what I heard,
On the show, and there are people that I mentored into vet school, and they've all said, I love mentoring now. Now I see it, right? Yeah. Teaching these young professionals to become the best version of themselves is very fulfilling, right? Yeah. And when you mentor, you don't want them to become you.
Right.
You just want them to learn and their way to do it.
I think that's one of the problems, right, is like the ego, like I was saying, right? Like, how much of an ego do you have as a mentor, and are you trying to turn that person, or you think that person should be you, and if they're not you, then, well, I'm not really going to write you a good reference.
Yeah, because the mentoring relationship is professional.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, intimate as well.
Right.
Right? It's a friendship. Yeah. It's a father. It's a parental figure. It's a however you want to say it is. And it needs to be a good mesh, but you, as the mentee, you have to be able to take feedback and not take it personally.
Right.
Because if there is a feedback that's given to you, it's for your betterment.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And you just be like, oh, shoot, I didn't even realize I was doing that. Or, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Like, don't be argumentative, because that's going to kill the mentor relationship
right.
immediately.
Sure.
So.
Yeah.
Now you finished VCA.
Yeah. And I just jumped straight into relief. And I just, I was treading water. I remember talking to my wife at that time, and I was like, am I making the biggest mistake of my life? Like, are we about to lose? I just bought, like, a home, like a condo. Like, you know, is it going to be a big problem? She's like...
What year was this?
This was 22... No, 21. 2021.
You got in at the right time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's when the whole profession basically just, at least here in Southern California, in my opinion, blew up.
Yeah.
As far as there are no doctors.
I know.
That want to work full-time, part-time.
Clients tell me that every day. Every day that I work, they're like, oh, are you going to be here? I love you. Are you going to be here? And I'm like, I'm sorry, I jump around. Well, where can I find you? And then I'm like, I can't really tell you that, because then the hospital I'm working at is not going to be happy about that.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you try to keep your hospitals within a certain location?
Yeah, right now I'm only working like probably 15-mile distances. I used to go out to like L.A., and this was before I had my son, and now it's like I need to be home. I need to make sure that my wife has support, that I spend time with my son before he goes to bed. You know, like the last thing I want is to be able to come home and he's already asleep kind of thing. So I'm 8 to 5.
And are there any stipulations?
In what way?
What do you, but like when you're like, yeah, I'll come in relief, but.
Oh, yeah, I've got a 5-page contract that they've got to sign, and if they don't, I'm not going to work there. It stipulates, you know, what they need to do, what I will do. I've got, you know, if they make me work overtime, they're paying me 150% of that hour. I've got, you know, if I'm sick, they can't retaliate against me for calling in sick. You have to have a certain number of technicians available to me at all times. I think that's a big piece of that question of like, what advice do you have for veterinarians jumping into relief? Be very careful with what contracts you believe these companies provide, because they don't. They really don't. When I would work for these companies that were doing relief and I would have problems, I would call them and I was like, I need paperwork. You need to show me the contract that this hospital signed to work for your company, to be a part of this group. And they're like, oh yeah, we don't have that. And I'm like, what holds them to stick to what they have said on the website?
Right.
Nothing. So what am I holding to?
Yeah, well, on the website too, it's, I wish on the websites that they have for these relief veterinarians, they'll be a little more specific as far as like privately owned, corporately owned.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, you know, it's like Banfield here, Banfield here, right, VCA. Right. Okay,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But if they're like Silent Creek,
right,
where they just bought out, is it privately owned?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, so you got to do a little. What I've done is you got to do a little bit of deep dive. And I hate to admit this, but you go on Google review, Yelp review.
Yeah. Oh, I do that too. Yeah,
because they could say, ever since this doctor left and this doctor left. Okay, so they're losing doctors.
Yeah.
There's a good chance there's something going down. Do you want to be part of that culture?
Well, and I also, for the ones that I do my own contract with, I increase my rate. So I go on, I check their Yelp, and if they've got bad Yelp reviews, then I'm like, ooh, okay, I'll work for you if you pay me this amount. So I almost kind of like weed them out a little bit in the sense of like, I'm going to increase that rate. And if you don't like that rate, then you're not going to take me on. And that's fine. But if you want to take me on, then okay.
How do you calculate your weight?
Being on these other relief websites, I've been able to kind of identify what is expected. I also know that those websites take on, you know, a certain percentage for themselves. And so when I see, do you want to know some, like, real numbers?
No, I'm. Let's just say you find a shift for $1,000 on a website.
Yeah.
How do those numbers break down?
So on that website, I get $1,000 because when I take that shift, that's the price that
yours.
I get.
Yeah.
Right. But then that hospital is probably paying $200 to the website for that shift.
So that's $1,200.
Right. So that shift is then $1,200 in reality.
So they're charging them 20% of the salary base.
Yeah, I think about that. I had a friend who owns a hospital and we kind of like looked at it together when we were having some drinks one night, and it was like, oh, this is interesting. Like, I can increase my rate because I know that this company and so many of these practices are using these companies, right? And so it's like, okay, if I can just cut them just under what they would have to pay, then we're solid.
Yeah, so like basically, it's $1,200 to go if you want to go through that company,
right?
But for me, it's $1,150.
Exactly, right.
See, that was the cool thing when corporate started buying everywhere because it was the easiest way to figure out your pricing.
Yeah,
you just go 25% underneath your competitor, and you got
right.
You're and like you're still going to be doing just fine.
Yeah, because you don't have the same overhead.
No.
Yeah, you're not paying, you know, 5 CEOs or whatever it is.
Right. My wife's still working, and they've had 5 fee increases this year.
Oh, man. Yeah, when I work at these corporations, every quarter, 5 in a year, right? Or you just said in the last couple months?
No, in the last year.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
5 fee increases.
Right. Every quarter.
Right?
Every quarter.
My wife's like, urine culture is $297. I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Urine culture is $297. I mean, when I owned it, I would do the urine culture add-on, and then I'd do the 2.5 times whatever the add-on price was.
Right.
And everyone used to yell at me, oh, you're giving away money. Giving it away. Well, you know what? I was still able to diagnose and treat and have great client relationships. You know, the cost of care is ridiculous right now.
Astronomical right now. Yeah. I was reading on Vin, and Mexico has put out a law trying to have more public veterinary hospitals, and they broke down how much the exam fee was versus the private Mexican hospitals and the public Mexican hospitals. It's like $2 an exam fee for a public and $10 an exam fee for a private. And it's like mind-blowing. Obviously, it's Mexico versus the United States, right? But like, these people are just as intelligent as we are, and they're getting pittance for what they're doing.
Well, yeah. Well, it's the economy of Mexico.
Sure. I mean,
but
I get the whole, like, side of that.
Nothing against Mexican veterinarians. I'm sure there's some amazing ones. But I work with a rescue group in Rocky Point.
Mm.
That's why I asked if you've been
there. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And the veterinarians that do their things, they're doing things that they should not ever attempt.
I mean, you could say that about some of the U.S. vets.
But if they would attempted, if a U.S. veterinarian would have attempted some of the things I've seen,
sure,
they would have lost their license immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it's crazy, too, because when you look at some of these clinics, I remember the regional manager telling me, oh, we just hired this new vet and he's just amazing. And I'm like, okay, why is he amazing? Oh, you should see his average client transaction.
Oh, man.
Oh, the ACT, the fucking most bullshit number there is to look at.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, that's great. And she's like, and I am so impressed. I just bought him a bone saw. So finally, I'm talking to my manager, and she's like, who is this guy? She looks him up. He's had his license suspended 3 times by the state board for malpractice.
This is a real story? Yeah.
Real story.
Oh, my gosh.
So I contact my regional manager back because I already couldn't stand her because her claim to fame was she was a manager of Lens Crafters.
Okay. Yeah, totally.
She had her associate's degree from FITM. University in Los Angeles, which is fashion and design.
Yeah.
So anyways, going back.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I'm glad you like this veterinarian, but I found some information that I'm going to email to you. And since then, she never even talked to me or tried to help me out because she was so pissed.
Right.
Well, I'm like, you got to know who you're dealing with here, right? Yeah. You know, that's, but you know, for me, that's that was one of the stories that just you look at some of the horror stories that there are out there.
Yeah.
What was your worst shift ever?
Oh man. Worst shift was as I literally walked in the hospital and went, oh crap, I do not want to lose my license. I walked in and they showed me, they did like the walk around. Every drug box was open. All the controlled substances were just up for grabs. Where they sat me down, I had a wall full of cages and animals and no notes. There weren't even names on them. And I asked the technician, I was like, you know, this one right behind me sounds like it's dying. Like, what's going on with it? Oh, I don't know. The doctor knows. They're not here. What medical notes do you have that I can read through so I can make sure that I know what's wrong with this pet if it dies? And, you know, what, I need to know something. I'm the doctor here. Oh, they don't write medical notes. And I was just like, blew my mind that I had walked into this hospital.
Holy, and did you walk right out?
I called one of this company and was like, I can't work here. Like, I'm going to lose my license. It took me until midday for them to finally get back at me and be like, can you please stay, do the best you can. And I was supposed to work there the next day. And I was like, I'm not working here the next day.
Oh, wow.
And then that the owner reached out to me and was like, you know, like, oh, if this makes you uncomfortable, like, you don't have to work here. And I was just like, what are you talking? This is bad. One of the other doctors there, she did relief and I pulled her aside. I thought she was a primary. And I was like, what is going on? Like, I was losing my mind. Like, I am deathly afraid that someone's going to walk in here and realize that I'm the doctor here. Yeah, I mean, that was just...
But you know what? Well, how does that fall? If there are issues within a clinic, how does that fall on the relief veterinarian? It doesn't really, because you don't own the management license.
True, but I think that...
But if something happens to an animal that's hospitalized there, you're going to be in.
Yeah, I'm the doctor on staff, right? And then my license is now being put into this cesspool. Yeah. So, like, that's one of those things where I like to have my contract in place.
Right.
So that because I have stipulations in there, like this, that, and the other has to be done. And if that's not the case, then in my contract it says, you know, I can walk away. And you still pay me. And you still pay me.
Any trouble ever receiving payment for relief shifts?
Luckily, no. Okay. Yeah, luckily, no. I mean, I've definitely heard about that. I had a colleague who she was out in Michigan for like 3 weeks and never got paid. She was San Diego vet. She went out there for 3 weeks or so, and she never saw a penny.
They never paid her?
Never paid her.
Wow. Did she have a signed contract?
I don't think so.
So another thing is always get everything in writing.
Always.
Don't ever trust what someone tells you.
Right.
Because that could come back and really bite you in the butt.
Yeah. 100%. Always have a contract.
Wow. Do you ever see yourself going back into private practice?
I actually thought about trying to like buy a practice, one that's here, and a veterinarian who was kind of like ready to retire idea. I just don't, at this point in my life, I don't want to commit that much of my time. That's like a 7-day, 24-hour job, you know, to like go start a practice or even take on someone else's practice. Deal with the staff, correct things that should be corrected. They, you know, like if they've got a boarding facility, that's one of those things that just like, I don't know if I want to deal with that.
Boarding facility, because that for sure. Oh, I mean, both of my practices at boarding facilities.
Yeah.
And I remember my very first day in Laguna. I walked through the door. It was the day after 4th of July. And my facilities manager grabs me and he goes, there was a problem with this dog. And it was a Doberman and it was bloating.
Oh, God.
I mean, I was on the job for 5 minutes.
Right.
And I was already in a bloat surgery.
Yeah. I mean, and that's boarding. Like, people board at veterinary hospitals thinking that it's like the safest thing, right?
But things still happen.
Oh, well, yeah.
Right?
Whose fault is it? No one's.
Nobody's.
And most of these places don't have 24-hour staff.
No.
You know, is there a video camera there? Like, no.
No. It's there's a lot of shady stuff that does go on. You know, and I'm hoping this profession does get turned around, because I think there is so much beauty in owning your own practice. There is so much, you know, you build it. But, you know, if they do what you want to do, which is you're starting your own Relief Veterinary Corporation, that's your baby that you're going to grow.
Right. I mean, and I've been contacted by other relief companies that they are veterinarians who are running their company and are hiring other veterinarians onto their company to be that veterinarian for those hospitals and provide relief, right? And so I think that that's a really interesting process. I mean, this one company who contacted me, I'm like, hey, man, I this is my region. You're trying to come into my region. We're going to have to play ball here. And it kind of put some stops to it. But yeah, I mean, I think that something that's really underutilized is the at-home veterinarian that like...
Oh, the house call.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. That like, I mean, there's definitely, they have them around, right?
I've always questioned that. I'm like, how do you, if you're going to do a house call veterinary practice, God bless you. But in Southern California, how are you going
to
do that?
Yeah. I mean, it's difficult to get around.
Yeah, exactly. You know, 4 miles could take you 4.5 hours.
Right. But I think that's one of those things where if the demand is enough and certain individuals believe so, then you get paid more, right? And then you only see like 5 clients a day. But if each of your exams is $300, you know, you're getting through.
Yeah. But most of the at-home veterinarians I've met here in Southern California, or at least in our area, kind of whack.
Yeah, I mean,
like they do horrible medicine.
They're running through their like 1960s Winnebago or something, right? Where it's like,
no, they have their vans are pretty cool and decked out.
I've been seeing some, like, yeah.
I mean,
some of them are. I agree with you.
I mean, you pick up a dog. Are you going to spay it there in the truck?
Right.
Where are you going to do X-rays?
Right.
What if something goes wrong on the truck?
I mean, but so I think the key there is to have a home-based hospital, and then you have these veterinarians in the neighborhood going out to people's homes. Truthfully, I think that like 80% of our job is looking at the animal and hearing the history, and almost 80% of that I can get to a good idea of exactly what's going on. And although I need to touch your pet and have a physical exam and develop that VPCR, most of my cases, I can walk in and within like 5 minutes, I already have a real good idea of what I need to do and I can treat your pet.
But you didn't have that immediately coming out of vet school.
Oh, God, no. Right. Yeah.
It took time.
Oh, yeah. 100%. I mean, that's, you know, that's the hours and the hours and the hours that we spend and all the animals that you see. And then you develop an idea of like, okay, here's the top 5 problems that most of us are going to see. Right.
Correct.
Ears, skin, eyes, vomiting, diarrhea.
And your first 3 are usually interrelated.
Right. Yeah. And if you kind of understand the primary causes of these things, then there's only a handful of drugs that you actually need to know.
Right.
And try those things. And then you tell the client, which I do this all the time, I'm going to hit the top 3 reasons why I think this is here. If you're not going to do the diagnostics, which a lot of times they don't, we're going to hit the top 3 reasons why
But make sure you write down in the chart that the client refused diagnostics.
Right. Oh, 100%. All the time. Write your notes all the time. Write your notes. That is 100%. Yeah, you have to. And always dictate, well, what happened. Absolutely. And then I tell them, like, okay, I'm going to send your, you know, you don't want to do x-rays, you don't want to do blood work. It's probably pancreatitis because you gave your dog steak this weekend. It was 4th of July and your neighbors threw over a hot dog and your dog's vomiting and having some diarrhea. Okay, you know, like, we can do X, Y, and Z. If they don't get better, come back. You know that we're going to be doing these diagnostics.
Right.
And I think that that's a very easy at-home visit to be able to be had. And then you send them to your primary practice when things aren't going well.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So if you're going to talk to any veterinary students that are coming out this May, what's the one thing you would tell them right now, this is what you need to work on?
You need to meditate. You need to learn how to, before I got into vet school, I was really working on meditation, and afterwards, after I was like not meditating as much, I was able to take 5 breaths and reach that Zen place. And I think that that's one of the biggest things, because it's like, you know, I mean, veterinary people are weird. Like, we're all weirdos. That's to get into this profession, you pretty much are a weirdo. Or you'd be a human doctor, and that's a different type of weirdo, I guess. But like, we have anxiety. We are, you know, we want to be the perfect person. And so that comes with stress and anxiety, right?
Correct.
Take a breath. Learn how to find that Zen to where you're not shaking, to where your brain works. And if you can't, like, if you can't think, you need to be able to find that place that, so, like, grounds you.
Oh, yeah, the grounding?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to learn how important it is to be humble, too.
Oh, yeah, right. Treat your staff well.
Oh,
please.
You're only as good as how strong your staff is.
Don't be that doctor with the ego that's screaming at people, throwing pens. That's assault.
Throwing pens, throwing car molts, throwing hemostats.
Yeah. I've heard razors.
Throwing scalpel blades.
Right.
Throwing syringes.
Yeah.
That's having temper tantrums.
Assault.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to just be careful.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, but then again, we used to call it initiation or hazing, but you know, what do I know?
Your generation did.
Yeah.
Yes, they did.
Yeah. You know, my generation was very lucky, and I'm worried about these generations coming up as far as this profession, as far as what's happening to it.
Yeah,
I'm hoping that we can make some definite changes. And if anyone wants to talk to you about setting up the relief idea,
yeah,
how do they contact you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on Instagram, so Dr. Gastrine is very searchable on Instagram. I've got little videos that I'm trying to educate my clients about, different diseases and things like that. So that's an easy way to get a hold of me.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, Dr. G.
This was cool. Yeah, Dr. G. No problem.
Yeah.
And we'll catch you next time.